Okay. Good morning, everyone. This is a meeting of the Investment Committee of the Milwaukee Employees Retirement System. Today's date is Thursday, September 7th, 2023. The time is now 9:02 a.m. Roll call, please.
Mr. Bell?
Here.
Ms. Ford is excused today. Mr. Helling?
Here.
Ms. King?
Here.
Mr. Conrad?
Here.
Mr. Kovac?
Here.
Ms. Sawa? Not present.
Here.
Oh, here? Okay.
No, here.
Thanks. Mr. Klusman?
Here.
Quorum?
Okay, thank you, Jan. We have I think you all saw quite a large agenda today. A lot of different things, and so I'll try to keep it moving as briskly as I can, but give you a lot of time because there's some complexities today, which I guess is pretty common these days. But I intend to take a break after item 5. Let everyone get up and go to the bathroom for 5 minutes, just so you can kind of pre-plan that. But starting with item 1, we have the approval of Mesereau's Private Equity Fund 9 LP side letter revision. Bryant?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, just we should go into
closed session. That's closed session?
Yep.
Okay, sorry. Please be advised that the Investment Committee may convene in closed session on the following item, which is 1, which I just read, as provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub e Wisconsin State Statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The Investment Committee may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. Do I have a motion to go into closed session?
Bell will motion.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Helling.
Second. Helling. Thank you, Mr. Helling. Roll call, please.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Ms. King?
Aye.
Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Mr. Kovac?
Aye.
Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye.
Quorum, and please say the time. I'll pause the recorder.
Time is 9:04 a.m.
Thank you. Now, go ahead.
Okay, the time is now 9:12 a.m. and we are back in open session. Could I have a motion for approval on item 1, please?
So moved. Molly
King. Yes. Thank you, Ms. King. And a second for Mr. Bell, I think I heard.
Yes, sir. Mr. Bell, second.
Great. Anyone opposed? Great. Hearing none. Item 1 is approved. Moving on to item 2, the Callan Private Equity Pacing and Reinvestments 2024 presentation. And Mike and John are in the office, I understand. Two gentlemen want to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is John Jackson from Callan. I'm going to cover the memo that you have before you, item number 2. This is a memo to the City of Milwaukee Retirement System from Callan. This was prepared by Gary Robertson, who's in our private equity group, has been a longtime employee of the firm. I'm going to go through this information at a fairly high level. The action items are twofold. With the recommendations to make an additional investment in the Abbott Annual Program 2024 and the Apogem Private Equity Fund 11 for $30 million. So as we look, the background that we have here is that each year, in conjunction with senior staff, Callan prepares an annual commitment pacing projection model. So this essentially provides a vehicle to account for investments made, distributions coming out of the program, as well as future commitments to target or maintain that target allocation that is now a 12% allocation to the program. Currently, the investment amount is 13.4% as of June 30. It was 13.6 as of March 31st, where a lot of the information contained in the memo stems from. The range for private equity is a 19 to 17%. So again, while above the stated 12%, certainly within a stone's throw of the target allocation. The program summary, it consists of 4 managers, 2 core managers, targeting a total of about approximately 70% of the exposure, And then they're supplemented with two specialty managers targeting 30% of the portfolio, that being a secondary fund and a small fund buyout program. The two core managers are Abbott and Mesereau. In terms of the history, you know, this program was launched in 2010. So we have these managers that have been invested and committed capital throughout time. As you look at the bottom of page one, you'll see that the portfolio is currently 59% paid in. So again, paid in is the amount actually sent to the funds, called by those funds, as opposed to committed capital. And it is returned 88 cents out of every dollar paid in. So again, while not you know, a fully mature program, certainly we're in the process of maturing. The earlier vintage year investments are paying out, throwing out a significant amount of cash. Performance for the program and the individual managers has been strong, appearing in the second quartile of the Cambridge Refinitiv peer universe. So the information, a lot of busy information contained on page two, but suffice to say that when we look over the life of the program, we see that the total value of DVPI is the total value over paid-in capital. And this represents not only the current NAV, but also distributions that have been made to the fund at approximately program-wide at about 1.9 for the funds that have earlier vintages. We're seeing a 2.0 for Abbott and 1.99. So that's the way to understand that is for every dollar invested, $2 have been returned or are part of the current NAV. So again, we've had a successful program. The idea here is we come through with this annual pacing study to maintain the commitment. So unlike a public securities investment where you plop a single amount, what we have here is a recurring commitments to add on funds, therefore to maintain that long-term exposure closer to the target. So accordingly, the next investment that we, according to our pacing study, is Abbott has a fund offering. First close is December of this year. First year fees will be waived by participating in the first close at $40 million. And Opigem Private Equity Fund 11 is $30 million. First close is scheduled sometime for 2024. And the benefit of being participating in that first close is that you receive discounts on the fees associated with it. So that is the high-level review. We think that the program has been operating successfully, both for these two particular funds, but as well for the other funds that are not currently requiring a commitment of capital. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Helley, is that you?
Back on the busy chart page, yep. In 2013, the specialty secondary fund three, how is that 105% funded? Did they ask for more? Or?
Okay, I'm sorry. So this is the specialty three?
The percentage paid in.
Right.
Neuberger SLF three.
Okay.
100%, everything else was under 100 or close to it. Just wondering why it's overpaid into.
Yeah, there are occasions where they'll have a recall of capital, they'll distribute the capital, and then they'll make a capital call for an additional amount that was in connection to an early sale of a security, for instance. So again, while the initial commitment amount was $30 million, the total paid-in amount was 31.3.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's a good observation, Mr. Helling. I think what we learned and what private equity managers learns is that, you know, when the private equity industry was just starting to take off, maybe in the late 90s, first decade of the 2000s, you know, people would commit, let's say $100 million, but they were oftentimes, you know, that money was committed but never fully called or invested. And basically for managers, increasingly in the last 5-10 years, have started asking for permission to what's considered overcommit. So, I mean, it can be 115%. I don't know if managers are getting up to 120% of committed now. And the idea is that, yeah, by committing 120%, by allowing a manager, whether it's Abbott, Mesereau, Neuberger, or Apogem, to take your $100 million and commit 120% of it, you know, they're still probably never going to get to 120%. They'll start returning capital. I think that's a key point that John said. You know, it's often contingent on returning capital. Not always, maybe, but oftentimes it might be, where they would have to actually start returning some of the money before they start committing more than the initial amount. It is a nuance with private equity. I mean, when it goes well, it certainly has benefits for investors like us. It's a way we can get lower fees potentially by paying fees on committed capital, not the 120% capital, things like that. The managers like it because they can get more money to work, maybe have a little more flexibility. Nothing's no risk, I mean, but there are controls around it. And the one that John mentioned is probably one of the biggest ones. They usually have to start returning money before they ever would go over that 100%.
Excellent. Thank you.
Great. Any other questions?
So the way this is set up, Mr. Chairman, if there are any questions on the presentation, it would be appropriate to ask them now, but we thought it would be appropriate to actually take the approval item up after the due diligence reports. In particular, I guess what we don't expect any issues, but one of the due diligence reports, for example, is on one of the managers you're asked to commit money to, so we just thought it. Just in case there's questions that didn't come up in Callan's presentation, but they come up in the due diligence reports that may or may not impact what you're being asked to approve today, that's why it's set up the way it is. So.
Well, that's excellent logic. Thank you for that. And it does seem to. I have heard other meetings where they do just the opposite. It's like, we're just approved to allocate a whole bunch more money to this person, and now we just found out in our due diligence report that there's concerns. You know, so yeah, that's excellent thinking. Good. So then if item two is all wrapped up, we will then move on to item three, the due diligence reports. And as David just mentioned, 3A is Abbott Capital. And Dave, you want to present that to us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. Eric and I conducted a routine visit with Abbott in their New York offices this June. Just as a refresher to on top of everything that Callan just went through, you know, Abbott is one of the four managers hired to invest private equity through the diversified fund vehicles that we use. Their approach emphasizes the importance of manager skill on performance within private equity. As Mike mentioned, they offer a new fund annually called the Annual Program, or AP Funds for short. And each AP fund targets a diversified mix of 25 to 40 managers across North American private equity, venture and growth equity, European private equity, and small buyout sectors. Abbott's preferred allocation also allows them the ability to do what they call opportunistic investments that comprise co-investments as well as secondary investments within the portfolio. If you notice this within the Callan chart, Seamers has committed a total of $410 million across 13 different AP funds since 2010, with approximately $315 million in invested capital as of March 31st. And that makes Abbott's allocation the largest mandate within the fund by market value among the four private equity managers. So really a key part of the core allocation. As mentioned by Mike as well, you know, Abbott's performance to date has really been very strong with all of our individual funds scoring in the first or second percentile of all the metrics that Callan pulled together for us. And of course, in addition to the prior commitments, you know, the committee is considering a new commitment for the 2024 fund in the amount of $40 million. While staff and Callan have no concerns about Abbott, I did want to just highlight a few items. There was a notable succession recently among senior leaders. Len Pangburn took over as president of the firm at the beginning of this year upon the retirement of Jonathan Roth. This transition had been well planned in advance, with Mr. Pangburn being promoted to co-president in 2021 to allow him to work side by side with Mr. Roth before taking over. We are really pleased with the overall stability of the Abbott team and their approach to these generational transitions. It was noted during our visit, and I thought this was impressive, that the remaining five most senior partners at the firm have all been working together since 2007. So just a really, really good core team there that they continue to maintain. So while this is not a concern at present, we do, of course, will continue to monitor how the team evolves over the years. Another item that I did want to mention was that opportunistic allocation within their standard allocation. This increased with the 2022 AP fund to potentially 25% of the portfolio being allocated to secondary and co-investment opportunities. We talked about this kind of at length with the Abbott team, and we're very comfortable with the approach that they described. So in recent years, the investment team has seen enough opportunities within both opportunity sets to fill.
You are in the meeting now.
To fill the 25% target allocation. But what we were pleased to hear especially was that they vowed they would not sacrifice underwriting standards to hit this target if there were not desirable opportunities available. So they weren't going to stretch beyond what they're comfortable with to force the allocation. The final item I'll mention is just in the firm's asset growth. We've mentioned this in the past, but you know, firm assets do continue to grow, but they're doing so in a very controlled manner, with a lot of that increase attributable to the gains in the underlying portfolios that have driven the strong performance we've talked about. And we talked about this with the investment team. You know, they indicated that they're still committing capital at only about 50% of their potential capacity, given just the overall growth of the private equity market, so still well within a comfortable range. So in conclusion, you know, we still continue to have confidence in the Abbott team. We think they can execute a well-diversified investment strategy within the private equity class, and really no concerns at all. So that concludes my prepared remarks, but I would, of course, be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Excellent. Any questions for Dave? Very good. Then we'll move on to item B with Eric Vandenberger-Berman, due diligence.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. As part of the same New York trip, Mr. Walters and I also met with Neuberger-Berman for their semi-annual due diligence. We were also, while we were out there, able to attend their annual investor conference, so it was a very efficient trip. I think so you'll remember Neuberger-Berman is a little bit different from our other private equity managers in that they manage a secondary fund, which means they are trying to, they're constructing the fund completely by buying existing interests, either from other investors or oftentimes directly from the general partner that's managing those funds. And that's different from, you know, our other managers that make mostly primary commitments and then, you know, just more around the edges add that secondary exposure to their portfolios. You know, the story with Neuberger is it's very stable. We're very happy with how things are going. The team is in good shape. They did some succession planning as well. They promoted Ben Pearl to co-head of secondaries. Mr. Pearl has been with the team for over 15 years, and it's been clear for a while that he's really the next generation behind the three founders that are really the key architects of the strategy. So it's nice to see that plan formalized and have that succession planning in place that, you know, should take provide stability for the team for the next couple of decades at least. As I mentioned, Neuberger has been doing more and more GP-led secondaries, so we spent a lot of time talking about that. It really came across that those are more labor intensive and they take more time to do, which is why Neuberger thinks that, you know, that's an area that they can have an edge, that, you know, not every manager is set up to do that. And Neuberger has been adding senior people to the team, you know, to make sure that they have enough coverage to really work those deals that take, you know, more time than a traditional secondary purchase. I think the other thing I'll add is that with what's going on in private equity right now, with interest rates rising, a lot of investors like us are overweight private equity. You know, in our case, it's only a slight overweight, so we're fortunate. Others are less fortunate, so they're maybe more motivated to sell things in the secondary market, and that plays right into Neuberger's strategy. So they said this is the best environment that they've seen for secondary purchases in the last 10 years. So I think we should feel pretty good about, you know, they're currently in the process of deploying Fund 5, and that's our largest commitment to Neuberger. So we should feel pretty good about that. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, that concludes my report.
Excellent. Any questions for Eric? Fantastic. Two great reports. And if you gentlemen ever consider changing the format of your reports, please don't. I really enjoy the way you lay them out with the opening, with the background. It helps me, at least as a board member, to conceptualize what the firm's all about, the size, the length we've been with them, and what they hold. And it makes it what's otherwise complex, a very easy read. So I appreciate Dave and Eric, your work.
Great. No, that's great to hear. I think, you know, we've got the report in a spot where, you know, we like the format. So we'll keep it that way for sure.
Thank you. Great. Then moving on to item 4, which is back to the topic from item 2. We have the approval of the 2024 private equity commitment recommendation. David, go ahead.
This is straight from Callan's presentation. What you're being asked to consider approving today is a $40 million commitment to Abbott Capital's AP 2024 fund and a $30 million to Apogen's AP 11 fund. Both of these are existing managers. It's kind of a reminder, we have four managers, as John said, and we always look to see who's coming in. That's part of the model, to see who's coming to the market. There's going to be some years where maybe we have tougher decisions or more talking about larger dollar amounts. But two of our managers are not coming to the market that we expect next year, and these are the two to consider. Staff agrees with the recommendation and all the work that was put into the analysis that you heard earlier at the meeting.
Excellent. Any questions for David or Kellen on this? Okay, how about a motion to approve?
Conrad will make the motion.
Oops. Okay, I heard a motion by Mr. Conrad, a second by Mr. Bell. Anyone disagree? Great. That's approved then. And move on to item 5, the approval of the private equity statement of investment policy update.
I'll take that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, I think it's pretty straightforward. There's a 6-page document that comprises our private equity statement investment policy update. Basically, the changes here were necessitated by the ALM study that we approved in June. That study made some changes to our overall strategic asset allocation targets for our asset classes. For private equity specifically, we raised our target from 10% to 12%. We reflected that change in our statement of investment policy for our overall fund in June, and now we're just going through and making sure the private equity This is actually our first investment committee meeting since we approved that ALM study in at the June board meeting. So this is, we're getting the small changes here where we just increased the target from 10 to 12, and all we're doing is increasing the range also on page 3 by the same 2%. I think it's page 3, Terry, if you're off. Bouncing around. Yeah, it's, there's something under B allocation. So, yep, stop. Oh, wait, go ahead.
There.
Yeah, there it is. So you'll see everything just going up by 2%. The target went from 10 to 12%, and the range used to be 7 to 15, and now it's 9 to 17. Those are the only changes that you're being asked to approve for this item.
Excellent. Any questions on that? Could we get a motion to approve then?
Mr. Helling, I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Mr. Helling.
Ms. King will second.
Thank you, Ms. King. Any opposed? Hearing none, that's approved. Okay, I know I mentioned that's the end of item 5. I mentioned at the beginning we take a 5-minute break here because we don't really want to break up 6, 7, and 8. That when we probably are going to start to feel we need one, but we're going to be going in and out of closed session, and there's quite a bit of information and presentation there. So anyone opposed to taking 5 minutes now so we can be refreshed as we embark on 6, 7, and 8? Great, so it'll just be 5. It's not a 5-minute break that turns into 10 or 15. It's 9:36 a.m. We'll break for 5 minutes and reconvene at 9:41. So Jan, you want to start the recorder?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, the time is 9:42 a.m. We're restarting the meeting. We are at item 6, which is the REAMS asset management presentation. It's posted for a closed session, but we're not going to go into closed session right away. David or the REAMS team will let us know when we need to do that. So I see REAMS on there, and I saw they have a nice office and they had their picture going. So gentlemen, want to give us the presentation?
Sure. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jason Poyer, and I'm joined by Scott Rosner, our head trader. Everyone has the materials, I presume, and so we'll get right into it, and we're happy to take questions along the way. In terms of just a quick update on REAMS, we are ended the quarter at 6:30 with $23.8 billion in assets. I believe today we're at about 24.2, so we've grown quite nicely year to date. Some of that is appreciation from assets, but we've also had some nice client wins as well, and interest in our products up and down our product slate. You can see our asset grid on slide 6. Core Plus is $7.3 billion. That's where the Milwaukee portfolio lies. And we've had some nice client wins there as well, additions from existing clients. We also saw our intermediate product more than double our assets with a large client mandate fund there as well in Q1, and long duration as well. So again, broad interest in our products based on a favorable long-term track record. So we have a lot of positive momentum. In terms of the team, just some quick updates on personnel. We have added over the last, call it 2.5 years, we've added 6 investment professionals, and I'm on slide 8 now. So we've added 6 professionals to the team over the last 2.5 years. That's a lot for REAMS. We're a small team, 15 investment professionals. But we've really transformed our investment team. Most notably in the last year, we added 2 members on the securitized team. Neil Agarwal joined in December as the head of the securitized team. And he ran in concert in parallel with Steve Vinson for about 6 months. Steve retired in April officially after more than 29 years at REAMS. So while we will miss Steve immensely, it's been great to have Neil aboard, as well as Ben Bird, a junior analyst, and they injected a lot of new ideas and momentum into that group, which, as we'll get into, is very topical because we're very active on the securitized side of late. We also added 2 junior members on the credit team, Reed Clark and Sydney Owen, both of whom have their CFAs now. And we added on the global rates and currencies, Dimitri Silva 2 years ago as a portfolio manager, and Antonina Tarasuk as a fixed income analyst. So really broadening our depth and horizons and our diversity and our youth amongst the team. So, you know, again, real positive momentum. And it dovetailed with our office move. You can see behind Scott and I, we're in our large conference room. We've been in Indianapolis now for almost a year and a half. So it's been really positive in terms of just having more clients come through, consultants, prospects, as well as retention and recruitment of a world-class investment staff. So that's absolutely been part and parcel, and one of the reasons why we relocated from Columbus, Indiana, where we worked for 40 years, 40 miles north to Indy here. So, and frankly, a lot of the team, including Scott and I, live in the Indianapolis suburbs, so it's a shorter commute as well. So that's really the firm update. Happy to take any questions or redirects before I turn over to Scott to talk a little bit about the fixed income markets in the first half of the year.
Any questions?
Okay, seeing none.
We'll move on. We'll just talk a little bit about the markets, which will lead into you know, some of the changes we've had in the portfolio this year in responding to that. So we've really seen an interesting divergence in terms of volatility between the rates markets and the risk asset markets, mostly being equities. We've actually seen volatility continue to be higher in the rates markets and much lower again in the risk markets, which is a little odd to see in the markets in general. But I think when you look at the Fed and what the Fed has been putting pressure on the markets in terms of rates, that explains a lot of where that divergence is coming from. You know, we've seen a lot of questions on when is the Fed finally going to stop raising rates and start cutting rates. And even as recently as the beginning of this year, markets were anticipating that the Fed would cut rates by September. Now, as we continue to move out, inflation has proven a little more stingy to come down than originally anticipated. We've seen markets start to assume that rates are going to stay higher for a little longer here. And the markets are now not expecting any cuts in Fed fund rate until at least June of 2024. So that's been pushed back pretty consistently and significantly just over the last few months. With that, the economy really has continued to prove fairly resilient, and especially in the jobs market. The most recent release, we've seen jobs numbers come down a little bit, but given the increase in rates that we've seen and the pressure that the Fed has been putting on rates, the payrolls and the job markets in general have continued to prove very resilient through all these rate moves that we've seen over the last 12 months. So what's that kind of pushing us to do? Well, on the macro front, we're finally seeing real rates, so, you know, nominal rates adjusted for inflation, at more attractive levels once again. And this is really the first time we've seen real rates approaching 2% here since the great financial crisis back in 2007 and 2008. So from our perspective, real rates being positive, being up closer to 2% again, is really giving us the opportunity to add duration to the portfolios and really get a little more aggressive there for the first time in really probably 12 or 13 years. And so as rates have risen and as we've seen real rates get positive and more attractive again, we've added to the duration of the portfolios overall throughout the year. One other place we're seeing some pressure is in the mortgage-backed and structured products. So mortgage-backed bonds, really two things leading towards cheapening in that sector. One is the Fed has ended their program of purchases of mortgage-backed securities and started to reduce their balance sheet. And the second is the rate volatility, which injects a lot of questions in terms of the cash flow assumptions that are going to be experienced for the mortgage-backed sector. And as those two questions and two issues have really continued to develop throughout this year, we've seen spreads in the mortgage-backed sector, again, become the most attractive that they've been since back in 2006, 2007. So we're really seeing a lot of opportunities in there. And as a result, we've responded to that by taking our exposure to mortgage-backed securities within the portfolio up throughout this year. Credit has been a little different story. We've seen some pockets of credit that have continued to be attractive, specifically the financials. However, as the year has gone on, spreads have tightened up in credit in general and also in the financial sector. So the one place that we still see a little bit of opportunity in credit has become less so over the last few months as those spreads have also tightened along in financials along with the rest of the credit market. So in response to that and in response to the opportunities that we've seen in the mortgage-backed space, we've taken our credit weight down so far this year. We've probably taken the mortgage exposure up by about 10% in the portfolio this year, and credit has come down about 10%. At this point, I wouldn't say credit is really strongly overvalued or undervalued. It's really kind of fairly valued at this point. And so we're keeping the exposure somewhat in line with the index, but we no longer have the strong overweight to the credit markets that we've had really over the last year. So I would say that's probably three of the biggest moves you've seen us make in the portfolio year to date is adding duration in response to real rates becoming more attractive. We've added to the mortgage exposure as we've seen that market get more attractive, and we've reduced our credit exposure as we feel there's just better opportunities elsewhere within the fixed income markets. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Jason to talk about our performance year to date and the attribution.
Thanks, Scott. So performance begins on slide 14. You can see the relationship began January 1st, 2001. So I'll note that's over 22 and a half years ago. So once again, we're very thankful for the longstanding confidence you've placed with Reams and the long relationship we've enjoyed with the city of Milwaukee. Reams is very fortunate to have many long-term, long-time customers like yourselves. And of course, we believe it's been hopefully a good two-way relationship. You can see portfolio gains. This really shows the beauty of compounding over 20 plus years of gains of nearly $300 million in the portfolio over that time frame. So you can see our performance on slide 15. This is year-to-date as of July 31st. Was positive 3.78. So we've really had a pretty strong first half of the year. You can see versus the aggregate index through 7 months was positive 202, so 176 basis points of outperformance. It certainly hasn't been a gangbusters year by any means, but it is good and nice to see a positive total return after a tumultuous total return picture for 2022 in fixed income land, and that leads to the negative returns for the last 1, 2, and 3 year annualized numbers that you see there, although we did outperform somewhat substantially. And I'll note the five-year return, 3.47 versus 0.75, is 273 basis points of outperformance per annum over the five-year track record. So a pretty good track record in Core Plus over the last 5 years and since inception. Turning to attribution, which is on slide 16, this breaks down the year-to-date numbers a little bit more. So we start on the top left with that positive 3.78 return and 176 basis points of outperformance. You can see it came pretty evenly between macro effects and selection effects. So duration added 83 basis points. We were mostly short duration in the first half of the year as rates have rose significantly. And then as Scott mentioned, we gradually added to duration over the course of the year to now to the point where we're actually slightly long duration, which is a little bit of a sea change for us given the attractiveness of real yields. So curve effects also added 13 basis points. by avoiding the very front end, which widened the most in concert with the Fed moves. And then you can see selection added 80 basis points. That's further broken down on the bottom left-hand side. You can see a lot of that came from actually high yield, where we used the derivative instrument, the CDX instrument, added 54 basis points in sector impact on that side. So our use of high yield was very additive in the first half, although we've certainly cut it down to a very modest stake at present. I believe it's just over 8% currently. But you can see we actually had nice contribution from other sectors as well, particularly mortgages. MBS added 23 basis points to performance. We were underweight mortgages entering the year. They've been an underperformer. But again, as Scott mentioned, they now are screening very attractively, and we've been adding over the course of the year to now we're significantly overweight. And then we've also seen positive contribution from investment grade corporates, largely from our financial holdings, which outperformed industrial holdings, as well as from CMBS at an 8 basis of outperformance. So again, nice, broad, diversified contributions in terms of where that outperformance came from year to date. Turning to slide 17, this shows a little bit of positioning as of 7/31. It isn't significantly changed a month later, but you can see duration at 6.9 years, so about a half a year long to the benchmark at 6.3. So again, that's gradually increased. We're really probably comfortable at about this point near term. I don't see us going significantly higher near term, you know, given the uncertainty with respect to yields and rates near term. So I don't think you'll see us move tremendously off the benchmark at this point. We're pretty content at about a half a year long to the bench. You can see our yield to worst at 5.4% versus 4.9. So we enjoy about a 50 basis point yield advantage versus the ag index. So that gives us a little bit of cushion should rates move a little bit higher going forward. And you can see our average quality is in line with the benchmark, so still very high quality portfolio. As Scott mentioned, valuation on a lot of the spread sectors is just adequate right now away from structured products. So we don't think it's necessary to move down the quality curve to try to pick up additional yield. That's really not a part of Ream's playbook. And the sector breakout is further gone into detail on the right-hand side. You can see we're underweight treasuries at 27%, overweight mortgage backs at 40.6% versus 28% on the index. And again, basically in line on corporates at 27.6 versus 24.8 on the index. As Scott already went over, that's been a reduction in corporates where we were heavily overweight in recent memory, and now we're just essentially equal weight, at least on a spread duration basis. So that really concludes our remarks on the portfolio, but happy to take any questions or redirects.
Excellent. Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, Mr. Conroy, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious about the current market and mortgage-backed securities. You notice many people are holding onto their houses because they have low mortgages. And so there seems to be fewer and fewer houses on the market, which means fewer and fewer opportunities to lend mortgages. Is this interest in mortgage-backed securities more tied to the higher interest rates, or is it also affected by just kind of a scarcity of mortgages that can be packaged, or is it a combination of these things? And the other question is, how long will it take these higher mortgage rates to work their way into the system when people are reluctant to buy new houses or reluctant to switch out their low-cost mortgages for a higher mortgage in a different property?
Great question, and I would say really there's several factors that have gone into, in our opinion, making this this sector much more attractive. First is, like you mentioned, the move in interest rates really has been pretty dramatic over the last year, and that's been one of the biggest factors that has had an impact on the mortgage-backed market. Now, part of our purchases of these are going to be securitized based on newly issued mortgages. And like you mentioned, there's a lot less of that market in play right now, just because there's less houses being sold, and you know, less people moving, just because you do have to refinance now at such higher rates. However, there's a lot of the mortgages that are out there that have been prepackaged, that are a little more seasoned, and that's where we're seeing a lot of these opportunities also. And as we saw rates increase and we saw volatility enter the rates market, that really cheapened up the mortgage-backed bond market pretty significantly over the last year. You know, as you see the rates moving up and down with the volatility, you know, that affects how people prepay their mortgages. And, you know, people with 3% mortgages are much less likely now to prepay that mortgage than somebody who would have had a much higher rate from years past. So that expectation of less cash flows coming in on these things and extending the duration out on these mortgages has really, in our opinion, been almost mispriced at this point by the markets, because too many people have pulled back and said, hey, this is kind of a scary place to be in mortgages. You know, with all the dynamics, maybe some people wanted to step back away from that market. And as that happened, the pricing for those bonds really was skewed into a much more attractive category versus what we could get elsewhere within the fixed income markets within like the corporate sector or the agency sector or other sovereign bonds and things like that. So it's really a lot of that volatility in rates that really repriced the entire mortgage market. And like I said, you know, that in conjunction with the fact that the Fed was buying mortgages for their balance sheet for many years, and so you've had a really large, massive buyer of mortgages step away from that market. So we saw them step away from those purchases in conjunction with some of that rates volatility. That really has skewed the pricing on the mortgage market overall and made it much more attractive. Again, very high quality AAA rated mortgage-backed bonds. You know, we don't have a lot of concern about the collateral. It's really based on the timing of the repayments. But we think that where that market is priced right now is pricing in those risks more than adequately. And so that's really what in conjunction of those two factors has really made that market much more attractive.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent question. Anyone else? Great. David, how do you want to handle this? You want to go into closed session over the next piece?
Yeah, I think it's a good time to do that.
Okay, then I'll read the statement. Please be advised that the investment committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following item 6, as provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub G, Wisconsin State Statutes, to confer with legal counsel regarding strategy to be adopted by the board with respect to litigation in which it is or likely to become involved. The investment committee may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. So could I get a motion to go into closed session?
Double motion.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. A second by?
Helling, second.
Mr. Helling, thank you. A roll call, Jan, please.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Ms. King?
Aye.
Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Mr. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye, and the time is 10:04 a.m.
Thank you. The recorder's paused. It's on now.
Okay, the time is 11:08 a.m. and we're back in open session. And wrapped up item 6, and we're going to move on to item 7, which is the Loomis sales guideline presentation. If Gary could get folks in. Let's know.
Is Brian on or shall you know?
Brian's on.
Yeah, so awesome.
And these people on as well. Reams people we really don't need at this point in time then.
You said you're finished with us from Reams?
Yes. Yeah, thank you for being available just in case we needed you again, Jason and Scott. But yeah, we're you can drop off now. Yeah, we can follow up with you. Later today or tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah, if necessary.
This is great.
Cool. Thanks.
Yep. Thank you.
Have a good
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks. Brian, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Brian, then if you're good to go, we're ready for you.
You know, I'll just do a very, 30-second, Mr. Chair. So just to bring us to, maybe you're ready to do this anyway, Brian. I apologize if I'm taking any way from you, but Brian's been talking to us about some proposed changes in the guidelines. They gave us something written. It was a couple weeks ago, it's fair to say. As you can see, there's 6 items here that they're going to talk about. The important thing is that, some of these might involve contract amendments. Some of these might involve a review of an LLC or LP document. You're not being asked to approve anything that Brian's going to be talking about today, but we thought it was really important to still have him. These are things that Loomis thinks are important to talk to us about, to introduce to us, and if you're receptive to some of these ideas, all of these ideas, you'll hear about them at a future meeting later this year. And if we can, when we have more time to have everything set up, there would be an approval item at that date. I just wanted to get that up front so no committee member is overwhelmed by anything Brian might be talking about today. So.
All right, thanks, David, for kicking us off. Thanks very much for the time today, and try not to take too much of your time going over these, but I would say that I would break this up into 2 different categories. The first page, I think, are areas that can help improve the actions that we take in the portfolio. And that's the first page. Second page, I would say, is more would be nice to have. As opposed to something that I think is going to change or enhance the strategy that we're managing under right now. So, back to the first page. The first topic to discuss is just the use of Treasury futures within the account. We use Treasury futures, U.S. Treasury futures, interest rate futures. In a majority of our multi-sector portfolios today, it is purely a way for us to manage duration in the portfolio. And if I think about your portfolio today and the way that it is put together, the duration of the bonds, the cash bonds in the portfolio, is about 4.5 years. And we are extending the duration of the portfolio out beyond that, using futures in a lot of different accounts. In your account in particular, we're not doing that. We're using U.S. Treasuries to do that. But in a lot of accounts, we're able to use a very liquid instrument in U.S. Treasury futures just to manage the portfolio duration. I find that this is an important time to bring this type of a topic up, just because of the shape of the yield curve
and our thoughts about the potential for yield curve going more in a normalized state at some point in time. And so futures is a more efficient way for us to express our views on the curve. Certainly when we look at the portfolio, we're looking at key rate duration buckets. And this is something that, you know, it allows us to really be a little bit more surgical as far as the amount of futures we can use and just where we want to express our views in the curve. If I think about the way the portfolio is set up today, we've expressed a small, I would call a steepener trade in most of our portfolios using futures. And so that means we think that the curve is eventually going to normalize and you won't have these really high short rates. Doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. We actually think that this could take a period of time, but we do think it's worth, given the amount of inversion that's taking place in the curve, we do think that it's worth having a steepening trade on in the portfolio. So we're really emphasizing the belly of the curve. We're a little bit longer. The key rate duration buckets, if I think about it, twos, fives, and tens, and really underweight the longer end from a key rate duration bucket. So this is, to me, just a really efficient way for us to express and move the portfolio duration. It's certainly not for speculation purposes. It's purely going to be used for the management of portfolio duration. I don't know if we want to stop and we can discuss, or if this is just something we want to go down the list and talk about each item. So I'm just going to stop there and wait for someone to direct me going forward.
That's usually good. If you, we'll bark out sometimes if we feel we need to, okay. But otherwise, if you pause every once in a while, yeah. Then that gives us a more organized way to chime in with a question.
Yeah, perfect. Okay. The second item on the list is the request to invest in individual bank loans. I traded bank loans at Loomis. I was the first bank loan trader here back in the early 2000s. Back then, a majority of companies in the levered finance space, which I would consider to be companies that are rated below investment grade, had both bank loans and high yield bonds in their capital structure. And so there was a fair amount of overlap as far as the issuers are concerned. Today, that's a very different market. Bank loans is a very different market today than it was 15 plus years ago. And that is largely because of the proliferation of CLOs today. And so today you have a number of issuers in the market that have only bank loans in their capital structure. And the bank loan market's as big, if not slightly bigger today than the high yield market is. So for me, I look at this as an additional opportunity set in the levered finance space for us to invest in. So today, if I think about the bank loan market, 70% of the issuers in the bank loan market do not have high yield bonds underneath their bank loans in the capital structure today. So that's a huge change to what we've seen in here recently. And so, and then the popularity of CLOs has also, I think, helped to accelerate the growth in the bank loan space. CLOs own upwards of 70% of the outstanding bank loans that are out there today. So. The other thing I would mention here is that recently our standalone bank loan team was merged into the full discretion team that I'm a part of. And with that change, it does give us expanded capabilities on the single name front from an analysis standpoint, which we think we can put to good use. We do think that some of the more aggressive financing that's taken place in the levered finance space in the last few years has taken place in the bank loan space. And again, part of that is the demand for loans from CLO structures. And we do think that at some point in time, there could be some additional vulnerability to bank loans from a performance standpoint. We'd like to be able to take advantage of that, similar to what we've done in the past with other areas. The flexibility of a multi-sector style portfolio really has allowed us to be very opportunistic at times and to go into areas where we think there's opportunity. We think there could be an opportunity in bank loans in the future. And so that's why we have to put this this request together to be adding to individual bank loans in the portfolio today. The third request was for the use of CDX. And in essence, what CDX is a credit default swap made up of an index of 100 underlying individual names in the high yield space. It's a very liquid tool that's very commonly used in the leveraged finance space again today. Certainly would allow us to increase and decrease exposure to the credit markets, and in particular the high yield market, where there is a somewhat of a correlation with high yield. Obviously, if you have 100 names within this basket that are high yield issuers, you're going to have some correlation to those 100 names. So this would allow us to adjust our credit exposure up or down in the portfolio in a pretty efficient manner quickly without incurring trading costs on individual corporate bonds. What we have typically done with other accounts that use this is if we've made the decision that we want to increase risk in the portfolio, and at times we felt that we were not able to add as many high-yield bonds at that point in time as we wanted to, we would buy CDX. So that increases our exposure to the risks that we want. And then as we're able to buy individual bonds, we can reduce the use of CDX to take that risk off. And so it's a little bit of a placeholder for us in the high-yield market until we can populate the portfolio with individual bonds that we're comfortable with. So it's a way for us, again, to really just express an opinion on exposure of risk within the credit markets. And certainly we can also use this as an exposure, if we want to, again, use it as a placeholder for cash bonds at any particular time. The next item on the list is the elimination of the 144A percentage limit. We have, as a rule at Loomis the last couple of years, reached out to all of our clients. And at this point in time, we don't see any value to a 144A restriction. This is something that was put in place 20, 30 years ago. The 144A market, it's a different way of registering a bond as opposed to SEC registration. And it really, it allows for companies to come to market with new issues a lot quicker and cheaper than the SEC registration process. It doesn't mean you have any less research or I should say releases from the company from a standpoint of earnings or any of the financial metrics. Our research analysts are very well versed in 144A companies and feel like they get very adequate disclosure from these companies. In essence, what's happened is that, in particular, the high yield market has turned to the 144A market for almost all of its issuance today. And so over 85% of the year-to-date issuance in high yield has been done in the 144A market. So it's gotten to the point now where the market does not distinguish between SEC-registered bonds and 144A market bonds. And so they're really interchangeable in here. So I know we have a generous guideline here. It's a 50% limit on 144A. We're currently right around 31-32% in there. So we do still have ample amount of room to add to 144A. However, I would call the risk positioning of this portfolio today more on the conservative side of history. What could happen is we could see an event that leads to a really good buying opportunity. And we could fill that space up in a matter of weeks, if that were to be the case, if we had a longer term opportunity. I would hate to see us get stopped out in buying in the portfolio because of this limitation, which I really, again, want to emphasize, there really isn't a value to a 144A limitation in a portfolio today, unlike maybe what it was 20 or so years ago. So, if there are other opinions about what the value is of a 144A percentage limit, I'd like to hear them, but we don't really see that today. I would also point out that we started to use a little bit more securitized in these portfolios, both the asset-backed market and some of the RMBS market are also 144A, and we're starting to see a little bit of growth although it's still very small as a percentage of the overall market in the investment grade world as well. So this is an area that continues to grow, this 144A world. And again, the market's not distinguishing on liquidity or disclosure between 144A bonds and SEC registered bonds today. So I do think that this is a guideline that at one point in time may have had some value, but today, in my mind, there's not a lot of value here. So we would suggest that eliminating that would, it does not really change the risk or the disclosure or the strategy of the portfolio today. Number five on the list, and this gets more into the nice to have part of the presentation, is the ability to use currency forwards. And so what we want to do here is similar to with interest rate futures, is we want to manage the portfolio's foreign currency risk and hedge at points in time. There have been situations, I can think back to a situation with South Africa where we were not a big fan of the currency, but we liked the level of yield. I think the unhedged yield on the South African government bonds was 10%. When we hedged out the currency, it was a 5%. It was a 5% interest rate after hedging. So there are times where the yield on a particular bond makes sense, even with the currency hedged. And so we do think that the ability to hedge currency in the portfolio would be nice to have. Certainly we want to utilize that through using FX forwards in here in the portfolio. So again, a nice to have type of issue. But I don't want to say that we're going to be speculating. We're not. This is purely for hedging purposes in here as well. So that would be something that we would look at as a kind of a one-off opportunity, not something that I would see us using to any large extent in the portfolio. And then the last piece of this would just be the use of a senior loan fund. And David, I know you made mention of a separate subscription agreement for the senior loan fund. And in essence, what this is a fund that invests in individual bank loans. It's managed by the bank loan team, which has now been merged into the full discretion team. It's typically a low double B average quality. The nice thing about this fund is that we can trade in and out of this fund on a twice a month basis. So the first and the 15th of the month, we can make subscription or redemption requests into this fund. And so as we want to dial up our loan exposure and look to get a basket of loans for the exposure, we can buy into this fund and also sell it if we need to as well. So I would say that in the absence of the ability to buy individual bank loans, which would much prefer that to be the way we go in the future with this portfolio, that this would be a fallback alternative for us to get exposure to the loan market. And again, we do think that this market is going to present us with an opportunity at some point in time. And so, we just would like to have a way to be able to gain exposure to it in here. Just given the size of that market, it's as big as high yield is today. We do think that there's a potential for an opportunity there in the future. So, I'll stop there.
Mr. Chair, this is Mr. Sauer.
Sure, Eric, go ahead.
Brian, just kind of going off what you just said there, I mean, if the committee would give you the ability to do the individual bank loans, would the loan fund then not be applicable, or would you want to still have both?
I don't think we would need it if we were to get the individual bank loans. I think it's, again, the individual bank loans can be more taxing on the custodial relationship that you have with your custodian bank. So that could be an issue. So I think that if we determine that that's not feasible, buying individual loans, then I think the fund would be a nice fallback for us to be able to get some exposure.
Okay.
Another question, Brian. So on number five, so I think maybe when we first read this, we got hung up on the hedged and unhedged piece, and maybe, so when you were just speaking, I think you just gave the example of hedging currency. I think you're asking for the ability to, at least in the language that was proposed, it looked like you're asking for both. Our organization has a little familiarity with this, but it's, I mean, is it, are you asking for hedged, is the unhedged piece important to you? Or is it really just the hedged piece that you spoke to?
It's really just the hedge piece, David. I think if we if we're going to express a view on a country or a currency, we're going to want to do it through a cash bond where there's yield and income, as opposed to buying a non-deliverable forward that just expresses a view on a currency outright. So I don't see us buying or investing going long non-deliverable forwards to express a view on a currency. Again, if we were going to express a view on a currency, we'd do it through a cash bond. So this is really just for those situations where we may see a local market that's attractive on a yield basis, but we're not necessarily in love with the currency, and so we want to protect the currency downside by hedging it, but still have an outright long position in a bond that has a yield component to it after the hedge.
All right. Just two follow-ups. We'll, after the meeting, Eric and or I will walk through the guidelines with you, and you probably have the ability currently to hedge a position in a local currency, but we'll show you the language that we look at, and if you and your firm still want more comfort, we'll definitely bring this back to the board as soon as we can to give you that comfort. That's I'm just speaking to the hedged piece.
Sure.
Though, what I said would not be true if you were doing unhedged, but that doesn't sound like what you're talking about. If you wouldn't mind, just because we have talked about it a little bit as part of our organization, a little bit recently. I'm intrigued if you wouldn't mind just spending a couple minutes saying why your firm view is more to express currency views through cash bonds than like an unhedged position or something like that. I think our organization would benefit from just hearing your view on that.
Yeah, I think it just goes back to our thought that majority of your return in fixed income over time is going to come from income as opposed to capital appreciation. If you go back and look, especially if you look at the high yield market in particular, go back and look at the returns on the high yield index over the last 10 years, and you can pick any 10-year period you want. The majority of your return from high yield, and also this, it's similar in the investment grade space as well, investment grade corporates. If you break out the return components into price return or capital appreciation and income, the majority of your return over time comes from income. And so, in our mind, we always want to be working on the assumption that we're going to have a yield advantage in these portfolios, and we want to drive towards as much income as we can get with a view that we're also going to provide total return over time as well. But, I wouldn't want to give up that income or that yield component by buying a forward that really just expresses a view on the movement of the currency. So, I just want to emphasize that income component's important to us, and I think it's a big piece of the overall strategy. So, I think that's why we would want to express that view in a local market using a cash bond.
Thank you. That's helpful.
This is Conrad. How do you view the difference in liquidity between just buying a bond as opposed to trading it forward?
Yeah, you're certainly, depending on the market, you know, there are forward markets that are going to be more liquid than others, for sure. I mean, if you look at the developed world, it's, you know, fairly liquid there. I think if we're talking about developed market sovereign debt, however, areas like Canada, probably the most liquid government market in the world besides the U.S., you know, Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, Brazil, those cash markets are very liquid as well. And so I think that we would be comfortable owning the cash, knowing that we have good liquidity to fall back on there. Certainly the derivatives markets in those major developed markets would be you know, strong as well. And certainly thinking about some of the EM markets, Brazil, Mexico in particular, it's good as well. So I think you've got good liquidity in both. I don't think we're at a disadvantage going into, you know, a large cash market. Certainly, if you get into maybe a little bit smaller local markets, you know, that I think the liquidity challenge becomes a little bit more pronounced in the cash areas versus forwards. But again, you know, I think the position sizing would be appropriate for the liquidity considerations when that was to arise.
Thank you. Your former boss, Dan Fuss, always taught us to always inquire about liquidity.
Yeah, and Dan sends his regards, by the way. I talked to him this morning before I got on the call, and certainly, you know, Dan's still, he's in the office today, and we were chatting, and, you know, he still brings up on our morning trading calls, he still wants to ask the desks about liquidity, and, you know, rightfully so. I totally agree with you, and we're very aware of you know, liquidity when we're talking about markets. We all learned from Dan as well, and so it's something that we ask about quite frequently before we make a decision.
Thank you.
Right. Any other questions? And David, now you said we're not acting on this today, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is helpful. We will, I think the investment team, I mean, in conjunction with Callan, we'll follow up with you, Brian, and I mean, just kind of, this presentation, I think, hopefully was really helpful for the committee. I know, I mean, yeah, I'm still learning things too. I think we'll talk about what was sent over and kind of comb through any questions, feedback we have. And yeah, I mean, our goal, I mean, for the investment committee is to get it, have something to approve. We'll strive for the next meeting to have something for you to formally consider. So,
great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Thanks.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you.
Bye.
Good. Yeah, I like that tack, David. Let us drink from the fire hose and then give us some time to cope with it. Okay, so that's that for item 7. Item 8, approval of the Reams Asset Management Guideline Change. I have a motion on that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Conrad?
Yes, thank you. I move we hold the Reams Asset Management Guideline Change request to be heard at the next board meeting pending written guidance from Callan.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad, for that motion. Is there a second?
Helling.
Thank you, Mr. Helling. Any opposed? Okay, so that's what we'll do. I guess you see now why I had that break earlier. We're going to go into some performance updates and some other stuff. Does anyone feel they need another break before we jump into this?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, it's just performance. The informational stuff we will not be going over, so.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, we'll jump right in.
And Mr. Chair, I don't need a break, but I do have a hard out at noon, just FYI, so I have to leave it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kovac. Okay, David, then Eric, if you want to run with item 9, the SEMER's second quarter 2023 performance update.
I will do that, thank you. And I'll try to hit all the high points without belaboring any of them, and hopefully everyone will be out here before lunchtime. One thing I'll note, I do apologize, this didn't make it into the packet, the hard copy. So if you rely on that hard copy for your files, it will be coming in a future Friday mailing. But I think we can all follow along with what Terry has on the screen or with what David sent out in his email. Terry, we'll start on slide 3. So this is just a slide where we kind of look at the overall market environment for the quarter. So you can see stocks were up strongly with the benchmark up 5.9%. Bonds were down a bit with the U.S. Ag down 0.8%. Our real assets blended benchmark was down 2.8. Private equity had a really strong benchmark return, and you'll remember the way we do this is it's actually the Russell 3000 return from the prior quarter. So this would be the first quarter Russell 3000 return plus a premium. In this quarter, that was 7.8% for that benchmark. And then our absolute return benchmark, the 90-day T-bill plus 3%. That was 2% for the quarter. So that led to a SEMER's benchmark return of positive 3%. We can go to the next slide. So, you know, how would you expect our fund to perform relative to that benchmark? You know, that depends on a few of these biases that we talk about every quarter. And this quarter, they were, you can see by the amount of red, they weren't really in our favor. So value went against us, Russell 3000 value up 4% versus the 3000 growth up 12.5%. Russell 2000 is small caps, that was up 5.2% versus the Russell 1000, the large cap benchmark up 8.6%. So small didn't really help us. Fixed income credit helped, so we look at Loomis versus the Ag for that, so they held up a little bit better than the Ag, so that was a small positive. And then private equity. So as typically happens in our second quarter performance, we're reflecting really two quarters of private equity reports. So it's Q4 of 22 and Q1 of 23. All got reflected this quarter, so that all rolled up into a 2.6% return, which we're honestly pretty happy with. In terms of, you know, what's going on in private equity, I kind of alluded to earlier when I was talking about Neuberger. Rates are high. The IPO market has been kind of soft since rates started going up. There's questions about venture capital valuations. So with all of that kind of going on, to have a 2.6% return over the past really two quarters of reports, that's not a bad real result. It just doesn't stack up well against that benchmark, which I mentioned is kind of based on public markets plus a premium. So that was a detractor. So you can see, total fund return for the quarter was up 2.2% net versus the benchmark, which was 3.0. We can move on to slide 5. Just briefly, I think just to show. As you'd expect with everything I just said, the shorter term numbers, we've got some underperformance, but the longer term numbers are still strong with outperformance versus the benchmark, as well as strong absolute returns over the 3, 5, 7, and 10, and even that 15-year is above 6.8, which will that'll be the new discount rate starting next year. We can go to slide 6 now. So this is the attribution. We kind of just dig a little bit deeper on what was driving performance. And again, it kind of goes along with what we mentioned earlier. So private equity Again, this is two quarters of reports coming in. Was not able to keep up with that benchmark return, so that led to a 67 basis point detraction in manager selection. Style bias and public equity, as I kind of mentioned already, our value bias and our small bias went against us. We also saw kind of a smaller impact from international versus domestic exposure there in public equity, so that all led to a 57 basis point detraction. We get a little bit of the private equity performance back because we were overweight to that asset class, which this is based on the benchmark. So because the benchmark did so well, the way attribution works is it gives us a little bit of a benefit for being overweight. And then within manager selection, we just wanted to highlight Brandis, that had kind of a standout performance. And they helped offset some of the underperformance with their manager performance. We can go to the next slide. You know, this is just, when you get to, we got two quarters of data in here, these charts start to become more interesting, so you can kind of see that chart on the top, cumulative attribution effects over time, so that you can see that what's driving our returns is really manager selection and style bias, with that broad category group allocation that's based on our funds, the weights and the deviations from target. David spends a lot of time trying to manage our cash flows and keep us as close to target as possible, so you wouldn't expect to see a big impact from that if we're staying close to target, and that's the case here. We want our returns to be driven by the manager selection, the way our managers are performing, and the style biases that the committee has put into place over the long term. We can go to slide 8 now. So this is just total fund versus universe. Again, this chart makes sense with what we've talked about up to this point. So the shorter term numbers, we kind of have these factors in the portfolio that are going against us. So we're right at median for the 1 year, a little bit below median year to date, and for the second quarter. But those longer term numbers are still stack up very well against our peers. So top quartile against our peers for all of those 3 through 10 year time periods. Terry, we can go all the way to slide 16 now. Just to touch on a couple developments that we were made aware of, within the past few months since the last time we presented to you. So Luma Sales, who you just heard from, they made an announcement that Elaine Stokes, who's been a longtime portfolio manager on the full discretion team, is planning to retire in February of 2024. So Matt Egan, who's currently the co-head with Elaine, he'll become the sole head, and he'll continue to be supported by Brian Kennedy, who you just heard from as a co-portfolio manager on that strategy. And Loomis, that they have a very deep team around that strategy. So this is certainly something that we'll watch closely with Callan, and continue to monitor. But there's no real immediate concerns. I was impressed with Brian just now, and I think we still have a lot of confidence in the team that remains at Loomis. Then additionally, in July, Mesereau announced some kind of succession planning related movements. So Tom Galoon, the president, he's transitioned to a senior advisor role, and Mark Sachs, the CEO of the private equity team, has transitioned to chairman. As part of the long-term succession planning, they promoted Bob DeBolt, who's been a longtime member of that team, chief investment officer, really has ownership of the investment process at that point. He's been promoted to CEO of private equity, and Christina Pierce and Ryan Fradronich, who are kind of Bob's two right hands on the investment team, they were all both promoted to senior managing director. We talked with Gary Robertson at Callan about this, kind of when it happened. I think he's comfortable. This is, you know, Mesereau is giving a really long runway for this. So I think Tom and Mark have said they'll, they're both going to stay around for several years and remain members of the investment committee. Mark, in particular, I think plans to be a very involved chairman, so he will still be meeting with clients. You know, that was one of the points that Gary made to us, is that, you know, with Bob taking on the CEO role, the client piece is maybe one of the things that really gets added to his plate. And I think with Mark keeping a lot of that client work, I think they have a long runway to ramp Bob up into that. So, again, comfortable with Mesereau's plan here as well, but I mean, these are, with both of these announcements are a big deal, so we wanted to certainly make you aware of them. Terry, we can go to slide 18 now, and we'll talk about public equity. Again, you know, no surprises here when we mention the small cap bias and the value bias going against us this year. So you can see, you know, the public equity portfolio underperformed the benchmark for the quarter and year to date. But again, longer term, you know, there's some nice outperformance there versus the benchmark, I think, which, you know, I think that means that the public equity portfolio is really working pretty well. You know, really nothing broken here. We're happy with how this is going. Next slide. Again, versus universe, you know, with that small and value bias, you expect us, when those go against us, we're not going to stack up as well versus our peers. That's the case in Q2 as well as year to date. Longer term, you know, looks better with some top quartile on there, or second quartile, so, you know, above median, which is what we want to see. I'll go to slide 22 now. You know, this is just kind of, you know, looks at the portfolio on price versus a bunch of metrics as a way of, you know, measuring the relative cheapness of the portfolio. And I think it's still, you can see it stacks up very well against the benchmark in terms of, you know, being cheap on a number of measures. And we've really set this up with the belief that cheap stocks outperform expensive stocks over time. So I think you can feel pretty good that, you know, as that plays out over the long term, that the portfolio is set up to benefit from that. We can go to slide 24 now. You know, I think on this chart with, as I mentioned, growth outperformed value for the quarter, so you expect to see growth managers like Poland and Blair on here when they're in favor. But, you know, I mentioned earlier, Brandis kind of had a standout performance, you know, strong second quarter, strong year to date. You know, really nice to see out of a value manager when their style may not necessarily be in favor to still be able to outperform. It's great to see. AQR as well, you know, it's a quantitative strategy, so they use valuation. They also kind of look at things like momentum and, you know, they're looking at countries and currencies in emerging markets. That portfolio has started off strong year to date versus the benchmark. And we just spoke to them the other day, and that's continued into the third quarter. So it's nice to see, you know, that portfolio doing well. Just on slide 25, quickly. Again, you know, not really anything that's really outside of expectations here. A manager like DFA Large Value, you'd kind of expect them to underperform when they're out of favor. You know, Earnest is underperforming a bit, but their, you know, their longer term numbers still look quite good. Feel comfortable with them. Again, a manager like Global Alpha Tilts, MFS, you know, both doing well long term. You know, no real concerns there. Castle Arc would maybe be the one, you know, you'd like to see them outperform when they're, you know, in a growth market. But, you know, their returns can be very lumpy. So, you know, it's not uncommon for them to go through periods like this where they have some underperformance, and then they'll really hit their stride and have a nice, strong positive. So over time, that you can see the longer-term numbers that have been positive. And, you know, we expect certainly no, they haven't given us any reason to believe that that anything's changed with their process. You know, we can go to slide 28 now, just touch on fixed income briefly. You know, I think the takeaway here is that there's a nice year-to-date return. So 2022, we went through a very painful market where interest rates rose. And you can see now, you know, even with the quarterly interest rates rose for the quarter, so that makes, you know, the quarterly return for the portfolio negative. But all the while, it's been generating, you know, cash flow from those interest payments that are now higher. And so we have a nice positive year-to-date return. So that's, you know, a nice position to be in for fixed income, you know, that we haven't seen in quite some time. We can go to slide 30 now. And, you know, you heard from Reams and Loomis today. Just again, reiterate that, you know, the performance has been strong longer term. Reams mentioned during their presentation that, you know, the yield on their portfolio is 5.4%, about a 50 basis point premium to the ag. Loomis is right around 6.2%. You know, so we've got a nice yield advantage there against the index, you know, for both Loomis and Reams. And, you know, we're happy with the opportunity in fixed income right now, and happy with the way the portfolio is set up to harvest it. And I'll, Terry, we can go to slide 38. I'll just sum up recent performance. You know, so through the second quarter, as we mentioned, the fund is at 5.6 versus 7.4 for the benchmark. We roughly matched in both July and August. So you can see 1.6, 1.6. Right now, our August estimate is down 1.3 versus down 1.3 for the benchmark. September, so we're going to run into the same issue with private equity that we saw this quarter. So, you know, the strong second quarter returns for stocks are going to lead to a strong private equity benchmark that gets reported in September. So we've reflected that here because we know it's going to happen. We don't have any private equity reports that have come in yet. So as those come in, if they're reflected in September, we think that'll close up some of that performance gap that we're showing right now for September. But it's, at least at this point, it's unlikely that it'll close up the full amount of that gap. So you may see when we do this, you know, a quarter from now, we're talking about private equity driving a bit of underperformance again. And then that, you know, gets us to the year-to-date return of 5.1 for the fund versus 7.7 for the benchmark, again, when taking into account that private equity that'll be reported, you know, at the end of the month. So that concludes my presentation. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions? Fantastic. The rest of that's good. Item 9, the rest on item 10, as David mentioned earlier, is informational for us to read on our own. Thank you to everyone. This was a big meeting, just like David anticipated, of 3 hours. You hit it right on the head. We're very fortunate to have such a, I'm always impressed by the staff and all of our managers and all you guys, David, Mike, and John from Callan and stuff. So it's just a very good feeling, although I got a headache from meetings like this. I know that we're very fortunate as pensioners and everyone else that's related to the fund to have such a fantastic staff on our work looking out for us. Any other comments by anybody else? Great, we got 1 minute to spare for Mr. Kovac, and then a motion to adjourn.
Bell will make the motion. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Second?
Seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Hearing no objections, the meeting's adjourned at 11:59 a.m.